Blog Talk Radio.
This is the PW Torch livecast for Thursday, May 18th, 2017. I'm Wade Keller, and it is Interview Thursday. Thanks for joining us today. And our guest on today's show is ex-WWE creative team member Kevin Eck, who has worn many hats in pro wrestling. He's now writing a blog, which we will talk about on today's program. Kevin, welcome back to the livecast.
Wade, it's great to be back. Thank you.
Always great to have you on. I always learn something new and take some insights away from your time with WWE and your observations on the business today. You come from such a long background covering wrestling on the outside, then spending years with the company on the inside. For the sake of our listeners who haven't heard you before, although after this they'll catch up on past interviews we've done, I'm sure. Give a little bit of background on your... when you first started to watch wrestling, what wrestlers or wrestling angle or match caught your interest at first, and the years that you spent in WWE, so people who want to call the show live or email us can ask questions about that time period.
Well, I'll give away my age here. I started as a very young boy in the mid-70s. That's when I discovered wrestling and became a fan. This is the WWF days, back when Bruno Sammartino was in his second reign as champion. Having grown up in Baltimore, we were a WWF city, and I went to monthly shows at what was then the Baltimore Civic Center, and was really hooked on it from, you know, about age six, and am still hooked to this day. As far as angles you mentioned, you know, something that sticks with me to this day from a young boy was the first heel turn I ever saw was Spiros Arion turning on Cheap J Strongbow, which was in about 74 or 75, I think. Because at that point, I knew there were good guys and bad guys, but I didn't know they ever changed. I thought once you were a good guy, that was it. And I didn't realize that, you know, guys could go back and forth. So that shocked me when Spiros Arion, you know, ripped up Cheap J Strongbow's headdress. But as far as being involved with the business after that, you know, I followed a career in journalism and went to work for the Baltimore Sun for a lot of years and wrote about wrestling for them. Had a blog there, had a brief period of time as the editor of WCW Magazine back in 2000 and 2001, and then joined the WWE creative team in 2011 and spent 3 years there.
Excellent. All right. In the news this week, Randy Orton spoke out on social media. Yeah. About dives and an indie wrestler working with Rip Rogers, wrote a synopsis of what he thinks every indie match is like. I detailed that in this week's Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter, and you can also read about that on pwtorch.com if this is kind of new to you, if you're listening and not sure on all of this. But we'll assume you have some working knowledge of this. Randy seems to be having fun with it. He retweeted a little video put together of somebody doing a dive off a diving board and him giving them an RKO out of nowhere into the pool. So, I mean, he's got a sense of humor about it. But I'm curious for your insight, Kevin, into Randy Orton, having worked around him and with him. I'm fascinated by that there's very different camps in wrestling. There always have been and there always will be about what style is the best, is one the right one. Is it good to have a mix of styles on the same show? Does a smaller wrestler doing a bunch of dives and not selling and getting at a bunch of high spots help them get over at the expense of the main event later? That tells a story the way Randy Orton feels. I'll ask a broad question, and then we'll get more specific from there. But what's kind of your reaction and take on Randy speaking out, not only on the topics that he did, but the tone that he took?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think Randy was trolling everyone. And I don't know that people should get all that worked up about it, because I think that's kind of, you know, was Randy's intention, was to you know, Randy's not a stupid guy, and I think he knew those comments were, you know, inflammatory, and some people were going to get all bent out of shape about it. And I think he kind of sat back and watched as, you know, exactly what he thought would happen did happen. But you got to consider and remember that, you know, Randy did come up kind of in a, you know, in a different era, and Randy did not have to pay a lot of dues on the indie circuit. He clearly was born into the business, third generation star, and was a, you know, he was like the natural. I mean, he was just born to be into this business, literally, and had such a knack for it that it came easy to him. So there wasn't a lot of struggling, even though he did, you know, spend some time in developmental at OVW. He was fast-tracked, became the youngest world heavyweight champion. So he has a different perspective than, you know, a lot of other guys came up through the indie ranks. So I think you have to look at it from there. But, you know, Randy, even people that don't know him, I think you can kind of tell just from when you see him, not so much in character, but if he's doing an out-of-character interview, you know, Randy likes to kind of get under people's skin a little bit. I think that's just kind of his personality. And, you know, I wish people didn't, you know, maybe take this quite as seriously as they did. But as far as the broader question of styles and things like that, I mean, look, the business has evolved, and it's always going to keep evolving. And, you know, we talked about earlier when I was a kid growing up and as a wrestling fan in the 70s, there was a time when a drop kick was a finishing move. Okay, now we see all these incredible moves, you know, that are just transitional moves nowadays. That would have been, you know, even, you know, when Jake Roberts did the DDT in the 80s and 90s, wow, the DDT was such a devastating move. No one could ever get up from that. Now, again, a DDT is a transition. You don't see a lot of DDTs ending matches these days. So the business has just evolved. And it's also evolved, you know, philosophically as far as what it is. It's, you know, you got to remember there was a time when the business was so protected. And even though, you know, the outsiders, people who weren't wrestling fans, could look at it and laugh and say, oh, that stuff's all fake. But, you know, it was protected, and a lot of fans truly believed, or, you know, if they didn't fully believe, they thought that at least certain aspects of it were real. So you got to look at it from that perspective, as to then later on when the business became more open and we knew that it was entertainment and everyone came out and said, yes, this is entertainment, I think people started looking at matches differently and looking at the business as a different type of art form. And now I think there's more emphasis on an entertaining match more so than necessarily, although wins and losses are still important, I think a lot of times now fans like to sit back and be entertained by a great match. And there's a certain expectation of high spots and high flying moves and acrobatics and things like that. So, you know, it's that's how the business has evolved into what we expect today. I can enjoy both aspects of it. Just like I always said, I could enjoy back in the day in the 80s when WWE became cartoonish and WCW was much more of a gritty, realistic product. I loved them both. I loved wrestling and I loved sports entertainment. And the same with today. I can appreciate a good old school match and somebody who works, you know, maybe Randy Orton style. You know, you're not going to see Randy Orton doing suicide dives and moonsaults, nor have you ever seen Triple H do any of those things, but that doesn't mean they can't have entertaining matches that I can get emotionally invested in. And I also enjoy the spot fest. You know, I understand where the old timers are coming from, and, you know, you see these spot fests and no one's selling and, oh my God, they're destroying the business. And I understand that. That's what they know. That's the business that they love. But we all have to accept that, like everything, things change and things evolve. And I think that's where we are.
Lot to unbox there. A great topic that Randy and Rip Rogers have sparked in indie wrestler Daniel Parker, who put up the initial critique of indie style match. Because while I agree with the conclusion that you have to accept in a general sense that the wrestling industry changes, and there's definitely people who don't, or definitely people who want to live in a time capsule that matches when they first became fans. And I've seen a lot of them over the years, and a lot of people just, they are fans of a certain type of and presentation of pro wrestling. And they think that's the best because that's what they enjoyed the most. I also think that just because it's inevitable that the pro wrestling business changes, that it's important to examine those changes as they occur and decide, is this a good change or a bad change? Is this a change that helps entertain the fans, engage the fans, and also draw money. Is this a change that works against that needlessly? And I find myself torn because I think that there's room to critique indie style, but at the same time, I think Randy Orton isn't, like, to me, somebody who can do all those moves, who chooses not to, has more credibility than somebody who can't do all those moves. I also think somebody has more credibility if you're not Randy Orton, third generation, born into the business, rushed into being the youngest world champion ever, have a 8-figure bank account in all likelihood, and sitting on a perch talking down to wrestlers in front of 150 people paying $8 in an armory somewhere as if the reason – well, first of all, it's just whether he's trolling or not, it's a shitty thing to say. And I don't like the word trolling because to me it just sounds like, well, I'm going to hurt your feelings, but don't worry. I didn't mean four eyes when I called you four eyes. It's like, no, that's not trolling. That's being a dick. And I think he was, you know, to me, trolling is like this cover story where I get to get away with saying something kind of prickish, but hey, I'm just trolling you and you're the fool for reacting. No, you're the dick for writing what you wrote. And so I'm like torn because I think his approach was prickish, and also from an indie wrestler standpoint, there's a lot of guys working really hard to get the attention that Randy Orton was born with because he's an Orton and a third generation wrestler. So of all these mixed feelings, now, like, I think what Randy started a good discussion. I don't think he went about it the right way. I'm not willing to use the excuse, well, it's trolling, so anyone who responds is the idiot, not Orton. All of that stuff, I'm all conflicted. So here's my first question in response to some really good points you made. If the business is changing, and you were part of this in WWE, and you've written about it in your blog about the Braun Strowman, Roman Reigns photo that WWE made Titus O'Neil delete. I know there were people in WWE who were appalled at it because people who were around that scene who told me that was meant to be a personal picture. So there's all these things that are changing. I think you examine every change and go, is this good or bad for wrestling? Not just think, well, whatever change happens is inevitable because the business changes. So is, from a style standpoint in the ring, and then I want to talk about creative with you, from a style standpoint in the ring, did you, and you probably had less interaction with this than you did on the storyline side and character side, but were you part of observing or even debating the philosophy of how a match should, the pace of a match on the undercard, or moves that should be done on an undercard in a way, in tempering them so or not overdoing certain spots or setting a tone for what a two count means and what a one count means and the drama that's involved in order to build towards getting the maximum immersive involvement by the fans and reactions by the fans later in the show? Because that's something that I think is sort of timeless. I think every show, the first, second, and third match affect how the crowd reacts to the final three matches. Is that something in your time in WWE you saw discussed or saw being a point of concern by wrestlers, agents, and the bookers?
Well, it was certainly something I saw discussed, but it was not. I was not part of those discussions, nor were any of the writers.
Yeah,
it was very clear delineation of what our responsibilities were. Not that we couldn't have suggestions. I mean, anytime we, you know, sat down and tried to script out a show or book a show, and we would put matches down, we always had a finish in mind of, or, you know, or if there was an angle, maybe something that would happen at the end of the match that leads to the finish, things of that nature. But we never. It was not our area of expertise to sit down and try and figure out the flow of the match or anything like that. That fell on the producers to do that. So, and again, they could also make creative suggestions. So everybody had kind of their voice could be heard, but there was also a delineation of this is kind of your area and this is kind of your area of expertise, but we'll take opinions from all. But I did hear those discussions, certainly with the producers, and with Vince and Hunter, there was definitely a consciousness of, well, we don't want to do too many gimmicks in or high spots in, you know, early on that might take away from matches that we're going to do later or in the main event. Good example was one year at Extreme Rules, or sometimes they run together for me, but it may have been TLC. I can't remember, but there was a match between Randy Orton and John Cena. And now, in the past, at those type of pay-per-views, you would have multiple matches, right, that would have these gimmicks. They were all gimmick matches.
Yeah.
But that year, Vince decided it's going to be a regular card. It's going to be straight wrestling matches, except for the main event between Randy and John, because we really want that to stand out. And if we do, and I think that only happened that one year.
I remember that.
But that was the philosophy that Vince wanted there, is anything else we do on the undercard is going to, might take away from Randy and John's match, and we want their match to stand out. I don't care whether the whole card is called Extreme Rules or TLC or whatever it was. So, I've seen that, and it's certainly something that when a card is being constructed or a TV show is being put together, there are thoughts of that. And I think that part of the philosophy in wrestling will be timeless, where you want, look, even at my level in, working as a talent in indie wrestling, we structure the card the same way. We go backstage and talk about what's going to happen in, the top couple of matches. And, if they're going to be even something as simple as, a low blow is going to lead to the finish or a ref bump. Well, if we were planning on doing that in one of the undercard matches, well, now guess what? You're not doing that. Come up with something else, because we're saving that for the main event. So I think that those kind of discussions, will always go on. And I think they should. I think that just makes sense, because look, there's a match order, and there's a pecking order, for a reason. So I don't think that's a bad thing by any stretch.
Cool. All right. I want to talk about the creative evolution during your time at WWE and how that fits with your evolution of following wrestling from the outside as a writer and as a fan when we come back from our first break. Our phone number, if you want to get in line on the phone banks, 515-605-9345. If you're already on hold, stay there. We'll get to your call soon. And if you have not pushed one on your Touchstone phone when you call, be sure to do that, because that is what moves you into the caller queue instead of in the background. All right, we'll be back right after this with Kevin Eck, ex-creative team member and wrestling blogger and so much more. If you're like me, you've got a list of your favorite podcasts that you listen to throughout the week, and also your favorite websites that you listen to throughout the week, but they don't always overlap. But in the case of PW Torch, they do. We hope not only will you listen to the PW Torch livecast every day, but also visit pwtorch.com every day for the latest insider perspective, breaking news, TV reports, live event reports, live pay-per-view coverage, exclusive editorials, and a wide range of other features. Check it out every day. It's mobile-friendly, desktop and laptop-friendly. Stay up to the minute, stay up to date with pwtorch.com. All right, we're back. I'm Wade Keller, joined by ex-WWE creative team member Kevin Eck. You can now read his blog. I think the best way to find it is just enter Kevin Eck blog on Google, and it is available at pressboxonline.com. Also, you recently interviewed former WWE ring announcer Justin Roberts, and thought that was a nice Q&A. Justin representing himself really well, and I think coming across real level-headed in his experience. And you said that his experience and what he wrote about Match Dears, I want to get into that a little bit later, just as a teaser here, because you said that what he had to say about Vince McMahon, Kevin Dunn, and Triple H, which I would say were the three of the people he was hardest on in the book, and understandably so, because they're top management. You're going to write about top management more than you're going to write about mid-level people. I want to talk about that a little bit with you later. But first, we caught a discussion, thanks to Randy Orton kind of sparking it with his Twitter engagement earlier this week, and talking about different styles of wrestling. You talked about the need or the desire within WWE, and as involved in indie wrestling as you are now and have been, to not have an undercard match show up a main event. From an evolution standpoint, do you have a philosophy on there being a different type of fan that you're serving at an indie show than the type of fan that Randy Orton is serving at a WWE show? Because that's, I think, part of the challenge of chewing on this, whether it was meant to be taken seriously or not. I think it sparks a legitimate conversation, which is Will Ospreay makes money by serving a different type of fan looking for a different type of experience than a Randy Orton does as part of a WWE machine. And you have been both places. So I'm curious your thoughts on that. Is Randy kind of missing, if we take Randy at face value, that he believes his style is superior and the indie style is damaging, it's superfluous and undisciplined and damaging? Do you think that Randy's missing a point, which is fans who go to indie shows, if it's 150, as he, you know, said, or a larger crowd or a smaller crowd, they're serving a different kind of fan and putting on a different kind of show?
Well, I think that's a fair statement. I do think the indie fans who are hardcore, who go to those shows, do have different expectations than the much broader WWE audience. But I think what WWE is successful at is that they can, there's something there for everyone, right? I think if you want to see kind of a more old school WWE main event style type of product, then there are matches on the card that do that. If you want to, if you're a fan who also likes indie wrestling, but you're also a WWE fan, I think, you know, certainly there are guys in WWE now who get to ply their trade and have a platform on the big stage who can have matches like that. And some of those guys are, you know, some of their biggest stars. AJ Styles immediately comes to mind as a guy who appeals to both the hardcore indie fans and the more casual, you know, WWE-only fans. So, you know, but yes, I think they're, if you're talking about an indie show where the fans are in the hundreds and not in the thousands, that, yeah, that's a different product, and I think there are different expectations there. For sure. I think that's a fair point.
Would Randy draw without being a star, without having the TV exposure, would the style of match Randy typically wrestles draw on the indie scene? Would he be in demand on the indie scene doing what he does if he had never been on WWE TV but was as talented as he is? Would he draw more than Will Ospreay when you're trying to draw, you know, 800 fans in an armory?
That's a great question, and I don't, you know, obviously we'll never know the answer to that, but it's an interesting question to ponder. I think Randy, while he may not do some of the spectacular high spots, and I guess over the years people have kind of poked fun at him for being the master of the chin lock and, you know, thing front face lock and things like that, I do think that Randy, because of his look, because of his charisma, the way he carries himself like a star, I think, you know, that comes through on the big stage of WWE, but I think it would come through even more in a more intimate setting. I mean, I think when Randy Orton walks into the ring, just because of his size, like I said, his presence, I think he has that star quality. Now, whether or not he would need to do, you know, a 450 splash when he has these other things going for him, I don't know, but it's an interesting question.
Yeah, And I'm not even it hasn't resolved in my mind, like, the answer to that question. I'm curious if Randy did not adjust his style of wrestling, and he had the match he had with Baron Corbin, or he had the match, I mean, really, you can really pick out any of his matches over the past few years. I'm not sure if that were his style, if that's what he did in the ring every time, that he'd be main eventing Ring of Honor. I think that he'd be seen as a guy who can't close a show when you have the Briscoes doing what the Briscoes do, or Adam Cole doing what Adam Cole does. And I think what works for Randy in WWE is being a cog in a machine that tells stories differently in the ring and benefits greatly from the presentation that they're larger-than-life superstars. And so when you have two or three hours of TV supporting your storylines every week, it allows you, I think, to tell the story in a ring differently than if you're trying to draw a crowd whose only exposure to you is when they see you at the wrestling show or maybe a clip on YouTube on the promotion's local website where you cut a promo or it's a, you know, video or something. But there's not that kind of relationship week to week with the wrestler. And I think that affords Randy the ability to work a certain, we'll say, more traditional style than an Adam Cole or a Kyle O'Reilly or Will Ospreay or Ricochet, where their goal is, my only relationship with fans is the 10 or 20 minutes that they have with me when they're at the building, and that's what's going to make the ability for me to be in demand and charge a lot for my appearance to go up. And so I feel like Randy's in a different business than Ricochet or the indie guys that he's critical of. And I'm not sure that those two worlds relate as much as Randy's criticism inherently requires for his criticism to apply.
Well, you know, there's certainly a mindset of, look, Randy learned at the feet of guys like Triple H. And, you know, Batista came up around that same time. And there was definitely a mindset among those guys that there was a main event style slash, you know, WWE style way of working. And that's what they learned. They did look down on guys that, you know, did the flippy moves, is, you know, sort of the way they would put it. And you don't need to do all that to get over. And, you know, and look, I get it. You know, it's just a different mindset. And had Randy, you know, instead of coming up in 2001, you know, Randy was coming up now in 2016 or 17, and he's not Randy Orton's, Bob Orton's son, you know, would he have gone a totally different way? Would he have to do a different style? You know, it's, again, these are all interesting things to ponder.
Yeah.
But again, like I said, you really have to go back to what their mindset was. And look, when Hunter became a guy who was head of talent relations, you know, it's funny because now he's seen as the mastermind behind NXT and the guy who's brought in all these, you know, great indie and New Japan stars. There was really a time, and I know Justin Roberts talks about this in his book, where he really looked down on those guys. Even a guy like AJ Styles was seen as, he's a guy that does all those flippy moves, and we already got guys here who do that. What do we need them for? You know, now I don't know whether Hunter has changed because he really, his philosophy has changed, or if he just thinks this is one of those, you know, best for business things, and, you know, he's had to change. So, yeah, but again, like I said, Randy just, you know, he comes about it honestly. Like, this is what he knows, and I think he does look at it as, you know, this is the main event way to work versus opposed to, you know, these guys are on the undercard. But again, and I know you said it just makes him, you know, you put it a little more bluntly than I did. It just makes him a dick, you know, to do this.
Yeah.
But again, that's you know, obviously that's kind of who Randy is. You know, he is kind of a dick.
Exactly.
You know, that's just the way he's going to, yeah.
And when somebody's at their core, you know, just a dick, I think you still call them out for it. You don't give them a pass. Like, well, why would you be mad at me for always kicking you in the nuts? Because I always do that. Well, because it's not okay. You know, it's like, just because that's who you are and what you do every day doesn't make it okay. Or at least doesn't make you immune to being called out for it. What makes Randy tick? He flies on, I wouldn't say flies under the radar. That's probably not the right term, because this week he certainly isn't. But he's, you know, people, you know, the term enigma has been used for Jeff Hardy. I think Randy Orton's this enigma. I can't sometimes tell if he's pro-management, anti-management, pro-establishment, anti-establishment, pro-WWE, rah-rah, anti-WWE, I'm here to collect a paycheck, but I understand what this company's really all about, and I'm just going to take advantage of it for my own personal gain. Like, where's Randy as a personality, as a person, and his dynamic with management and the company? How is he different than the typical, if there is such a thing, main event guy in WWE?
Well, I mean, I think it's complex, as sort of the way you pointed out there. It's hard to categorize Randy as, you know, put him in a label him as he's either this or he's that. But again, remember, we've seen Randy since he was, 23 years old, and, you know, he's been in the company for 15, 16 years now. So we've seen Randy grow up in the company, literally. And again, you know, everything's going to evolve, including his maturity level and things like that. So I don't know that you can say, well, he's a rebel or he's a company guy. I think there are parts of, you know, he's part all of those things. I always saw Randy as kind of a no-nonsense, maybe. It's like he would not hesitate to tell you if he thought something was stupid, you know, like, especially as a writer, and you're going to present him with a promo, and he'd look at it and say, oh, that's stupid, I wouldn't say that. Or, you know, sometimes he was right, you know, but then you just have to say, well, it's been approved by Vince. Well, now you're saying it, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
I saw Randy as a guy who would just kind of, you know, didn't have a lot of a filter, and would just kind of call it as he saw it. But I think Randy is smart enough to know that he's in a really good spot. He's making a lot of money. And in some ways, he's fortunate to have that spot. It, as you said, he had an open door into the business. But, you know, that only takes you so far. And you're going to have to produce, or it doesn't matter who your father and your grandfather are, you're not going to be around. You know, look, Ted DiBiase Jr. had a pretty famous father, too, and it didn't really work out for him. There are other instances. So I think Randy has, you know, he is an enigma in the sense that he's such a natural talent. He's very good at what he does. He was very good at it from an early age. He knows he's good at it. And, you know, he knows that he's also in a position where he doesn't always have to toe the company line because of who he is. And that's the best way I can sum up Randy Orton. But he's a complex individual. There's some people who worked with him who hated it, that said, you know, Randy's just, I'm talking about people behind the scenes, not wrestlers, who, you know, didn't like working with him because he was hard to deal with. And there were others who said, you know, you just got to take Randy, you know, for what he is, and he's harmless. And, you know, that was more, my experience was more the latter. Anytime I worked with him, it was never bad. I remember one time I presented him with a promo and he thought it was, you know, he looked at the first line and he's just like, this is stupid. Why would I say that? Why? And when I explained it to him, he thought about it and he's like, oh, okay. All right. And that, to me, that was Randy in a nutshell.
Was he somebody who was a student of the game just in general, when you were there, was he a student of the game in that he was kind of looking at the big picture of where WWE was going, how they were working his character into things, how he might tweak things? Or was he kind of, like you said just now, in that example, hand me the script, I'm going to give my input, I'm going to go do my thing, and then I'm going to clock out. Like, do you think he's kind of paying attention to the larger scheme and really involved in evaluating what's going on? Or is he just kind of, tell me what I got to do, I'll have my opinion, and then I'm going to do it or alter it?
I mean, from my perspective, during the time that I was at WWE and worked with him, I did not see him as necessarily a big-picture guy or a guy who wanted to be super involved with everything that's going on in the product. You know, for example, a guy like John Cena, very invested in everything, wanted to, you know, who are the young guys who are coming up?
Yeah.
You know, who could I give advice to that I, you know, who do I see something in? I never saw Randy as that kind of guy ever. Now, if he was, maybe it happened outside the scope of what I saw, but I did see him more as a look, I'm here. I'm going to give it my all while I'm here. And then I'm going to clock out. And I think that is a pretty fair assessment.
Great. All right. Time is flying by. We're going to do calls right after this second commercial break, our bottom of the hour break. And when we come back, more with Kevin Eck and your phone calls. When you're looking to tune in live to the PW Torch livecast, find out about the next episode, or just catch up on an episode you missed, go to our new website, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can select shows by specific day, specific host, and format, including a grid of our latest interviews and best of selections on the homepage. That is pwtorchlivecast.com, where you can stream our show live and listen to past shows on demand. That's pwtorchlivecast.com. All right, we are back. I'm Wade Keller, joined by ex-WWE creative team member Kevin Eck. Kevin, can you plug your blog a little bit, and also anything you have coming up with MCW, and anything else that you want to mention, social media or otherwise?
Well, yes, I can always plug my stuff.
Yes.
I appreciate that opportunity.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, the column, the weekly column that I do, it's on PressBoxOnline.com, which is a Baltimore-based sports website. But, you know, me being a Baltimore guy, I love Baltimore sports, and I also do some work for them behind the scenes. But, of course, I had to have a pro wrestling column for them, which is a national pro wrestling column. It's not specifically related to Baltimore. But the column is called The Hot Tag. It comes out every Wednesday. The column that's up this week, I took a fun look at, you know, the Rock was making headlines with saying that he's considering seriously running for president in 2020. So I thought, well, you know, who are 12 other former and current wrestling stars who, you know, could run for president? And obviously it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek look at that. Last week, the column I did that got a lot of attention was on five ideas that I pitched during my time in WWE that were ultimately rejected. So whenever I, you know, kind of give people a peek behind the curtain, I think, with storyline ideas and maybe how things went down, that always seems to spark interest. So I'll do those things from time to time. Q&As. Next week I've got a Q&A with Bruce Pritchard from Impact Wrestling, who's bringing his podcast. He's doing a live one in Baltimore the day of Extreme Rules. So, you know, it's a lot of it is WWE centric because that's the, that seems to be what gets the most traffic, you know, no surprise there. But, yeah, it's my take and my insight, on wrestling, you know, week in and week out.
what's coming up on the indie scene that you're involved in?
Oh, yeah, MCW. Well, we have a show coming up in June the 9th in Joppa, Maryland, Slamboree, which now we've got a lot of people coming in, like James Storm. The artist formerly known as Jack Swagger is going to be there, Gail Kim, some others. My group, the Ectorage, is actually not on that show. We're like Dennis Stamp and Beyond the Mat. We're not booked, so we won't be there. But we're in our Speedos on our trampoline, potentially waiting for the phone to ring. And then our big show is in July. The MCW version of WrestleMania is the Shamrock Cup. It's one of the hottest and best indie one-night tournaments. Actually, this year it's a two-nighter. July 14th and 15th, I believe, are the dates. Don't hold me to that. I don't have my laptop right in front of me, but it's mid-July. The Shamrock Cup is coming up, and Leo Rush has won. He's the only two-time winner of the Shamrock Cup, and he will be back, I believe, trying to make it three in a row.
Awesome. And what's the website where people can find out more information about MCW?
It is mcwprowrestling.com.
Excellent. All right, let's go to our first call, and thank everybody for your patience here. Brian from North Carolina, VIP member, you are up first.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing today?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good.
Hey, I wanted to get your opinion on what's going on with Sasha Banks. She took the loss to Alicia Fox on Monday night, and it looks like they've really downplayed her, and they've really made a mess out of the Divas division. I'd like to get your thoughts on both Diva divisions, SmackDown and Raw.
Good question. Kevin, what do you think?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, we have to be politically correct as well. It's the women's division now. It's no longer the Divas division.
Sorry.
That's okay. My thoughts on Sasha Banks, it was, I have to admit, I was surprised that she lost to Alicia Fox, like I'm sure a lot of people were, but I was actually pleasantly surprised. I think there's something there in Alicia, and I think, if Sasha needs something to do, and if she's going to have a program with Alicia Fox, well, Alicia Fox has to at least win one to get a program started. So I don't think that's, a case necessarily of Sasha being buried. But I do, I don't know this for a fact, but I think there may be a perception among management in WWE that Sasha may be a little bit overrated and not quite as good as maybe she or some fans think she is. I don't know that to be fact, but I honestly, that's my opinion. I don't think Sasha is, I think she's great, but I don't know, if she's as great as maybe people thought she was. To me, and I thought this pretty much from day one when they came to the main roster, is that Charlotte is the bigger star of the two and by far, the biggest star of the division. Sasha was a great rival for her, but to me, there was never any question of ultimately who was going to be the bigger star and who was going to carry the division. To me, it was always Charlotte. I'm not necessarily debating on who has the better in-ring skills right now, just overall presentation, mic skills, presence, all those things, the size that Charlotte has. To me, she's the standard bearer of the division. And I think what you're seeing with Sasha right now is just, she's not involved in the main program on Raw. That's Bayley and Alexa Bliss. And I think they're keeping her away from Nia Jax right now. So the Alicia Fox thing is something to kind of bridge the gap. And again, if you're going to make a program, it can't be one-sided. Alicia has to get in something. And I think Alicia Fox is actually kind of underrated. So I was pleasantly surprised at that result.
How much did you see of wrestlers having a reputation when they arrived to the main roster and Vince McMahon, Triple H, whomever in power, using that, either being aware or not aware of that reputation? I guess that's the first question, is are they really aware of their reputation, and then did they kind of hold it against them or hold them to that standard, or do they look for ways to chip away at misperceptions of that reputation, either because they're better or worse than their reputation has? Like, does having a reputation when you arrive on the main roster work for you or against you, or not at all?
Well, I think it really depends, it's a case-by-case thing. It depends on the individual, and it depends on who takes an interest in you. I think there were some easy examples of, guys where it didn't work for them. CM Punk, you know, I heard many times that, you know, that Punk's good, but he's nowhere near as good as he thinks he is. And I heard the same thing about Dolph Ziggler. You know, he thinks he's Shawn Michaels, but, you know, he's no Shawn Michaels. I heard, you know, with those two guys, I heard that a lot. But, you know, since I left the company, I mean, you see guys like Kevin Owens, who Triple H clearly likes and has, you know, I mean, he couldn't have gotten off to a better start, right? His debut, he interrupted a John Cena promo. He beat John Cena clean in his first pay-per-view match. So, you know, again, I think it's a case-by-case basis. Had NXT not developed into what it's developed into, I could have easily seen, you know, maybe back when I was there, 2011, 2012, 20, you know, those are the years, Kevin Owens coming in and people saying, well, Kevin Steen, who cares what he did in ROH? And look at him, he's out of shape, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's not that, he thinks he's good, but he's not that good. You know, I could have easily seen something like that happening a few years ago, but I think that mindset has changed to some extent now.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, you know, somebody who goes through the NXT system and earns a reputation there is going to have a better go of it because they earn their reputation on Triple H's watch. And certainly if he recommended them for the main roster, there'll be a reinforcement of the good aspects of the reputation. Where if somebody comes in who has a reputation from outside of the WWE system, that reputation might be harder. But in the case of Sasha Banks, it kind of, Kevin Owens and Sasha Banks are proof that that's not always the case. You can develop a reputation in developmental and then come up short in the eyes of people on the main roster, mainly Vince McMahon, who have control over you. So, I mean, yeah, you got to earn it. And do you think that the evaluation in that way is usually fair, or do you think sometimes other things play into factors that shouldn't matter, play into whether somebody is deemed living up to their reputation or not?
I think ultimately what it is it's Vince McMahon's perception of you. And I think if you go back to the Sasha thing, you know, I think, you know, like we just said, if you came up through the NXT system, Triple H is going to do everything in his power to make sure you succeed.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Vince is going to be the guy. And I don't know this for sure, but I have a feeling that it was Vince who, you know, looked at Sasha and said, I just don't think she's as good as some people think she is. That's my perception of it. And,
yeah.
You know, I whether it's fair or unfair, and again, I think in some cases it's accurate. Some cases it's not. I mean, look, going back many years, Chris Jericho wrote about it in his book that, you know, he came in with a lot of fanfare from WCW and people were expecting big things from him. And he was kind of floundering in the beginning. And at one point, Vince said to him, you know, you sold me a bill of goods. You're not anywhere near as good as I thought you were.
Yep.
You know?
Absolutely. Everybody fight.
But
I mean,
the cream always rises to the top. But, you know, it always, talent wins out, right?
Yeah.
And look what Chris Jericho, you know, has turned into from those days of when he struggled early on.
And he had to adjust and be and put his ego aside and be open-minded to the idea that maybe there's some things he did outside of WWE that need some cleaning up or improvement. And there's guys who come in. You know, Samoa Joe talked about that in an interview this week. We've got details over at pwpodcasts.com on Samoa Joe talking about the adjustment from where he's been to WWE. And every wrestler goes through that. You know, especially when you have as much experience as a Jericho or a Joe, you know, you walk in, you're like, they're going to expect me to know everything. They're going to think that I think I know everything. And maybe I think I know everything or maybe I don't, but the reality is, no matter what, you're going to adjust one way or the other. AJ obviously adjusted quickly, and he even says that. It took me like, you know, a week to figure things out. You know, talking to Jericho, he helped.
Right.
And learned a few, you know, they told me a few things I needed to know, and boom, now I'm off to the races. And other people, it's a struggle. You know, it takes months or even longer. Okay, let's do another call.
Well, it's personalities as well. And I want to use CM Punk as the example.
Yeah.
CM Punk's never had a confidence problem. And CM Punk rubs people the wrong way. I don't think that's any secret. And I think when he first came into WWE, like, you know, he knows he's good.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it was like he was projecting, I'm a know-it-all and I'm above this or whatever it is, but that's certainly the way some people looked at him is, you know, hey, look, kid, we don't care what you've done at Ring of Honor or whatever else, you know, IWA Mid-South, you're in the big leagues now. So, you know, it's like, you know, on the one hand, they want you to not cower and be confident, but on the other hand, don't be too confident. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you haven't done anything yet, so you've done it here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I understand having that mentality. I mean, given the size and success of WWE, their attitude more than ever can be, you haven't done anything until you've done it here, but you're here for a reason. but you got to earn your keep.
Right.
And that's fair. All right, we're going to go to some calls after our next break here. Denny in Toledo and Kenny in Mobile, Alabama are up next. And we'll have more with Kevin Eck after this break. We know you're a pro wrestling fan because you're listening to the PW Torch livecast. There's a good chance you're also a fan of the UFC and all of mixed martial arts. And if so, we hope you'll check out our sister website at MMATorch.com, covering the news of MMA every single day with breaking news, exclusive analysis, an array of columns, live event coverage, flashbacks, and so much more. Check it out. That's MMATorch.com or download the free MMA Torch app in the iPhone and Android app stores. That's MMATorch.com. All right, we're back. I'm Wade Keller, editor of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter. If you're not a subscriber to the newsletter, you can get home delivery of the newsletter and details on home delivery at pwtorch.com/papercopy. That's pwtorch.com/papercopy. And if you want to get a digital subscription along with tons of other benefits, over 1,500 back issues of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter since the late 1980s, chronicling all the big, medium, and small stories in professional wrestling, my star ratings and reviews of every WrestleMania since 1989, I believe, 88 was the first WrestleMania I covered, and roundtable reviews from the Torch staff of every pay-per-view from then until now, and so much more, all available in text, PDF, or both in our back issue section, plus ad-free access to our website, our VIP website on mobile, and our VIP website on desktop. Ad-free access and plug-free access to this show, along with over a dozen other exclusive podcasts per week with diverse formats, diverse hosts. The Fix with Todd Martin went up yesterday, a very popular show with VIP members. The Bruce Mitchell Audio Show, dating back to 2004, is a weekly staple of the VIP experience on weekends, and so much more with Sean Radican, Travis Bryant, and Pat McNeil and Jim Valley with the Wayback Playback on Sundays, and retro radio shows hosted by John Arezzi from the early 90s. Great stuff. Go check out more details on what comes with a VIP membership at pwtorch.com/govip. That's pwtorch.com/govip. Give it a try if you haven't, or come on back if for some reason you let your subscription lapse. We'd love to have you as a member. There is a lot waiting for you on the VIP site. All right, Kevin Eck, ex-creative team member, is my guest, and we are taking your calls. And up next is Denny from Toledo, Ohio. Denny, thanks for calling. What's on your mind this afternoon?
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Before I get started on the real subject, I'm seeing Spurs fans are suing Pachulia. Do you guys think that means that maybe we as WWE fans can get together and sue Roman Reigns for hurting Braun Strowman?
probably not, but if you start a campaign, I will make mention of it on the website.
Okay, all right. Speaking of Roman, I was watching the promo on Monday, and I even heard someone call in on the live cast Monday and think that, oh, this could be a teaser for a heel turn. And as much as everyone wants to believe it's true, I look at it a different way. I think that they're trying to present Roman as a badass, and they have forgotten how to book a badass, because they had the greatest badass babyface of all time in Stone Cold Steve Austin, and this promo that he cut Monday, he comes out and he felt like he was entitled to that title shot, whereas I felt like if they were booking Stone Cold Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin would have come out and said, well, I want that title shot, and if I have to beat four jackasses to get it, I'm going to do that. But Roman didn't, seem like he didn't want to go through that match. And then, he tried to cut down Finn Balor so I just feel like they're trying to present him as a badass, but they've forgotten how to book a badass.
Interesting. Yeah. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that promo was certainly on the heelish side, because, yeah, he didn't say, hey, whatever I got to do to, jump through whatever hoops I have to jump through, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to earn that shot. He basically said, hey, I've already earned that shot. Give it to me. My perception there is, again, I'm trying to get into the head of Vince McMahon and having been around him for a few years and how he thinks. A lot of times he likes to have what you would think a traditional babyface would do, but then not go that route because
That's almost sickening that a babyface would act like Roman earned that shot. God damn it, why wouldn't he demand it? You know, I think there's like that's realistic. You know, so I think that that may have been why we saw the approach that he took. You know, and again, if you looked at it, if this were a shoot and you're Roman Reigns and you took out the guy who was going to be Brock Lesnar's challenger, I guess, you know, you would sort of have a good argument. Like, I should get that shot. Why do I have to be in a fatal five-way? You know, I think there's something to that. But certainly, that's not what you would expect from a traditional babyface, or like you said, an ass-kicking babyface would demand the shot and then say, well, whatever I got to do, I'm going to do it and take it. You know, I really don't know. Look, we've all wanted Roman Reigns to turn heel for so long. I don't know whether it's ever going to happen. You know, it seems like Vince has settled into basically making Roman what he is, and if the fans are going to cheer for him, okay, and if they're going to boo him, that's okay too. Like, this is just like, you know, it's like that horrible you know, I'm not a good guy, I'm not a bad guy, I'm just the guy. I think that's where they're going. Like, he's mostly a baby face. Like, I don't think he's ever gonna do anything really heelish, but you know, he's not going to be your standard white hat wearing baby face either.
It's going to be a challenge if they, to me, you're a babyface if you're mainly booked against heels. I mean, I just think that defines you. You're a babyface. And I don't think they're going to be booking him all that often against other babyfaces, but they did with Finn Balor. So, I mean, the idea that they might book him in a way where he isn't, I don't know. I mean, if they start making a trend out of booking him against 50-50, baby faces and heels, that's going to be an interesting creative experiment to say, he's a top guy, but we really are going to live up. We're not just going to pay lip service to the idea that he's not a baby face, he's not a heel, he's just Roman Reigns, he's the guy. If they actually deliver on that, that's going to be an interesting experiment. Because in the way pro wrestling presents itself, the goal is to get people to root for somebody and against somebody else in matches. And if Roman is you're flipping back and forth all the time, whether you're rooting for him or against him. And the idea is he's just such a big star. It doesn't matter if your emotions are tugged in different directions week to week and month to month. It's an interesting experiment within the pro wrestling genre. I think it sounds cool and progressive and outside the box, but I'm not sure that it works.
I don't know. Time will tell. I don't know why Vince just doesn't do the obvious thing and make him a heel.
I know.
Like, we talked about this ad nauseum. Yeah. I don't know why we just don't go there. You know, but, yeah, against Finn Balor, obviously, Balor's going to be cheered and Roman's going to be booed out of that's just the way it's going to be. And I think they know that. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, that's just the way it's going to be. But we're not turning Roman full-fledged heel. And he'll be wrestling a heel next week, and, you know, it'll be back to 50-50 or whatever it was, whatever it'll be.
Absolutely. All right, I'm going to we're relatively short on time. I still want to talk about your the rejected storyline ideas and a couple other things I jotted notes down on here. But I want to get a few calls in from people who have been on hold, too. So let's go to Kenny in Mobile, Alabama. Kenny, what is your question or comment for Kevin Eck? Go ahead, Kenny. Are you there, Kenny? We can't hear you.
Yeah, I'm here, so I have to call on mute.
Yep, that's all right. That's what I figured. That's why I held on. It happens. What's up?
Thank you. In a hurry, so a quick question. One thing that I've noticed that we don't see a lot of anymore is filming outside of the arena and segments like the Cesaro and Sheamus bar segment they had a few months ago. My question is, like, as a writer, do you get to, pitch that idea, like, hey, let's go offset somewhere and do something like that? Or is that more of a producer's job to say, hey, we like your idea, we're going to go somewhere else with it?
No, we definitely, the writing team definitely pitched things like that were done offsite. And, you know, I don't know what it's like now, but, you know, again, back when I was there, it was anything we could do. The philosophy was, anything we could do to ever get outside the realm of the arena or the ring, like, we should do that because that's going to help tell stories in a different way. It's going to give the program a little bit of a different feel, and it's going to enhance the characters and develop characters. So there was always a thought of how can we somehow take this to an off-site setting. Now that you mention it, I hadn't really noticed it, but it does seem like there really haven't been too many on-site things recently. So I don't know if that philosophy has changed, or, you know, maybe the storylines just haven't lent themselves to any great off-site ideas. But it was always the thinking was, you know, what can we do to get outside the arena that can further the stories and develops the characters.
Kenny, anything else?
I guess that's it for today, but I appreciate it. And I enjoy it. One reason I enjoy WWE more so than UFC is the storytelling of it, you know? So I enjoy when I do stuff like that. I appreciate you taking my call.
Absolutely. Let's go to another Kenny in Gallatin, Tennessee. Kenny, what's on your mind this afternoon?
Hey, Wade. Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. Yeah, thanks.
Kevin, I believe I had called before, and I'm understanding you have done some work for Ring of Honor in the past, right?
Yeah, I actually still do. I write for their website.
Excellent. Well, I actually got some Ring of Honor questions for you. It involves the last week's pay-per-view that they did with New Japan, and I want to get your thoughts on the whole Adam Cole being kicked out of the Bullet Club in favor of Marty Scurll, the villain. I mean, I watched that segment. I couldn't watch the pay-per-view, but I watched the segment later on online, and I just thought it was just so amazing. It's just like the setup and everything when he comes out with the Bullet Club t-shirt, and then Young Bucks do a super kick on Cole, basically just to, in essence, kick him out of the club. I mean, of course, we all know that his time with Ring of Honor is just about up, and I want to get your opinions on the angle itself. Where do you think Adam Cole might wind up? And also, the recent news of the parent company, Sinclair, purchasing Tribune Media.
Well, I'll address the storyline with Adam Cole first. I agree with you. I thought it was very well done. And it was certainly wasn't a well-kept secret that was going to be one of Adam Cole's final appearances in Ring of Honor, so they had to do something. And it shocked me. You know, I write for the website, but I'm not privy at all to any creative decisions that are being made. So I was surprised to see Marty Scurll be the guy that was inserted into the Bullet Club. But I think it's a great choice, and I thought the execution was well done. And you know, it's very familiar of this. There's sort of a trend now with you know, the Young Bucks kind of kicking guys out of the Bullet Club when they're headed elsewhere. When they're headed out, you know, they did it with Finn Balor, they did it with AJ, and now it happened with Adam Cole. So, you know, I liked the way it was done. I think it shocked people, but it got over. You know, Adam Cole, I assume, like everyone else, that he's headed to NXT. It's a big loss for Ring of Honor, clearly. Adam Cole's a very talented guy. I think he'll do well in NXT. It'll just be a matter of time before he's on the main roster. But I will say this about ROH. They have shown an ability to lose these guys like Punk, like Joe, like Roderick Strong, and, you know, now you can add Adam Cole and others to the list, and they keep going. Daniel Bryan, you know, you can name all of them. But they have a system in place, and ROH is more based on a style of wrestling and a philosophy and not entirely built around stars. Stars are going to come out of that, but they can, because of that style and the fans' demand for a certain style from that product, like you can insert it's like next man up. You know, it's like the old football saying, when somebody gets hurt, next man up. So Adam Cole leaving is going to open up a spot for someone else to rise up. I don't know, from a business standpoint, I don't know what Tribune and, you know, being purchased by Sinclair Broadcasting is going to mean, if anything, for Ring of Honor. That's something I think we're just going to have to take a wait and see approach on.
Very good. Kenny, anything else?
Yeah, just one more quick question in regards to Adam Cole. As you probably know, in the summer, New Japan is planning on doing some shows in Los Angeles around the area of Long Beach, and they already announced that they're going to create a new title, a United States Championship title. My question is, in regards to what Adam Cole's future is going to be, you know, obviously, I'm not sure if he still has some dates with New Japan or not, but do you see him as possibly being like the future face, as far as like the U.S. face for New Japan? Like, he and Kenny Omega could have some great matches in and around the U.S. circuit in California or New York whenever they make tours around the Pacific or in the Atlantic coast, to where if things go well, that New Japan might explore beyond those regions and possibly go with a, literally a worldwide tour for them in across the United States of America. And that's really all I had. And thanks for taking my call. And you guys have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, Kenny.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, look, that scenario is certainly attractive, I think, to any wrestling fan. Would be Adam Cole and Kenny Omega and having a big battle. And, you know, Adam Cole being one of the faces of this of New Japan's push into the USA and this United States Championship that they're having. I don't know. I mean, I'm still under the impression that Adam Cole is going to end up in NXT. So as great of a scenario as that is, I don't know that Adam Cole is necessarily going to be a guy that's involved in that. I think you might see a guy like Jay Lethal perhaps, you know, be that guy as sort of the U.S. Face for New Japan Pro Wrestling. We'll have to wait and see how that goes. But, yeah, New Japan expanding, you know, slowly but surely into the United States is very exciting, I think, for any hardcore wrestling fan. And, you know, I don't know necessarily what it means ultimately for the relationship with New Japan and Ring of Honor. It seems like there's still going to be a working relationship there, at least for now. But, you know, certainly New Japan, a lot more American fans know about it today because of, you know, obviously the internet, social media, and everything else. And it's very exciting. It presents a totally different style from what you see in WWE or anything else. And, you know, to me, the more the better, right? The more different styles, the more different promotions, and certainly New Japan's the number two promotion in the world right now. And it's going to be very exciting and interesting to see what happens as they expand in the U.S.
Yeah, and it's possible that there's going to be a gap between the wrestlers from Ring of Honor going to WWE or NXT just to avoid the perception that WWE, from a legal sensitivity standpoint, is raiding or tampering with ROH contracted talent. So they might let X amount of months go by before bringing them in. So it seems like they're grabbing them out of free agency rather than yanking them out of Ring of Honor. So that may be at play, too. Right. Something Jason Powell talked about yesterday on the live cast. All right, here's an email question I want to get to. This is from Carl. He said, yes, I said it. Vince has never made a superstar. Okay, that may be somewhat hyperbole, but just listen. All this time, I've thought that Vince was a wrestling genius, but now I look back at that history of WWE, and I've come to realize that the only big thing he was able to create and put over was the WWE brand name. Everyone he's tried to put over has, in essence, failed as an act. Not saying that it hasn't been profitable, just not over with the fans. Here's my argument. He's only capitalized and marketed what other people have already created. Not that that's a bad thing, but it does bring things into context. Here's the list. Hulk Hogan. He was already made in the AWA. Vince put him on the big stage. Lex Luger. Lex Express. You see what happened. Stone Cold Steve Austin. Vince's idea was a ringmaster. Austin created himself. Vince capitalized. Rocky Maivia, a failed babyface, rejected by the fans. The Rock, he made his own character and eventually surpassed anything Vince could have offered. John Cena was Vince's creation, still not fully over with the crowd. Yes, he's making money and kids love him, and he's good for the brand, but he'll never get love from the entire crowd. And Roman, Vince's creation, we'll see where that is. What are your thoughts or counters? I'd love to hear another perspective. I just don't see how Vince thinks he can pick them because he doesn't seem like he really can. Is that at all fair, Kevin?
There are certain aspects of that that I think indeed are fair. But you got to look at, okay, maybe Vince didn't create, if we're going to look at Hulk Hogan, he didn't create Hulkamania. That did happen on Vern Gagne's watch in the AWA. But I think you can credit Vince with then recognizing that if you're going to go national and you're going to take WWE to the heights that he took it, that you needed a guy to put in that position. And while it's true, Vince did not create that guy, he identified who that person was, and it was clearly Hulk Hogan, and as we know, the rest is history. I think, you know, a lot of those examples he brought up, I think that's fair as far as, you know, these are guys that Vince didn't necessarily create, but that happened, whether it was through making their name somewhere else first or coming up with their own idea after Vince's failed vision for them. I don't agree with the John Cena thing, though, because, I mean, John Cena is a huge star, and we can say, well, he's made a lot of money, but he's not really, you know, the guy or whatever. I disagree with that. Yeah. And look, I think it's very oversimplified to say, well, Vince is a genius. Or on the other hand, to say, oh, God, Vince is the luckiest guy in the world. He's just kind of, all this stuff has fallen into his lap. And you know, I think it's neither one of those things are true. I think Vince is a very smart guy, business savvy for, you know, this empire that he's created. But has he sometimes been out of touch? Has he sometimes missed the mark? Sometimes big? Yeah, absolutely. That has happened. But look, it's a bottom line business, and you certainly can't argue with the bottom line or the empire and the imprint on popular culture that Vince McMahon has created. But yeah, his track record on, you know, looking at a guy and saying he's going to be the guy. Yeah, it's you know, I think it's fair to say it's not necessarily all that great.
Another email. This has to do with your five rejected storylines. Confessions of a former WWE creative writer. Five pitches that were rejected. This went up earlier this month. Again, best way to find this, well, you remember, is just Kevin Eck, E-C-K, blog. And the first return on Google is this Pressbox blog that you do, Kevin. So people want to read this. There's five different ideas. But Chris from Ann Arbor has a question on one of them. He says, one of Kevin Eck's five rejected pitches involves Big Show unmasking Alberto Del Rio's father, Dos Caras, to get heat. Kevin says Vince McMahon shot down the pitch for two reasons. The American audience wouldn't grasp how sacred the mask is to Mexican wrestlers, and a senior citizen in street clothes wearing a mask would look ridiculous. Let's say Vince endorsed the idea. Would Dos Caras have agreed to unmasking in WWE, or was this a potential issue that might have prevented the angle?
It's a good question, and we'll never know the answer because it never got past, you know, the pitching stage to Vince. My thought was, when I pitched it, was that if we did it in a certain way, where that Dos Caras Sr.'s face was never actually shown, and that the intention was never to show his face. It was going to be one of those unmaskings where it was shot in a certain way, where the mask is ripped off, but he was still able to conceal his face. That's the way I envisioned it and the way I pitched it. So I would like to believe that Dos Caras Sr. would have gone along with it, and you know, for the sake of you know, Alberto getting a nice angle, and a program out of it. But I don't know for a fact that he would have agreed to it, or that Alberto would have even wanted his dad to do it. Like I said, it never got out of the pitching stage.
You did not write this in your column, but which of those five do you think would have done the best? Which one do you think Vince made the biggest mistake not accepting? There was Cody and Brandi Rhodes as a new Goldust and Marlena. There was the romance of Cody Rhodes and Caitlyn. Big Show assaulting Alberto Del Rio's father. Faction of former indie stars, kind of the precursor to The Shield or a variation of that. And Dean Ambrose and AJ Lee hook up and end up being a Bonnie and Clyde type act. Which of those do you like the best, and which of those do you, in it, maybe none of them, but do you look back on and cringe a little or think, yeah, Vince was probably right to reject it?
Well, obviously, since they were all my ideas that I loved, I won't look back and say that Vince was right in rejecting them. Although you can say that with Dean Ambrose, certainly things turned out well. Look, Dean was going to probably end up being in a good spot no matter what, and you know, we were trying to come up with different scenarios that would get him there. So I don't think you can argue in any way that The Shield wasn't, you know, fantastic.
Yeah.
And you know, had we done a couple of those other things that I pitched there with, you know, the faction of indie talent, which I had him part of, the thing with AJ Lee. You know, in the long run, it was probably better, right, that those things didn't happen and that The Shield, you know, was born the way they were. I think just from a fun standpoint, as far as writing and booking it, I think AJ and Dean, as you know, and the pitch was that they meet. We were going to have AJ committed. I don't know if people remember the angle, but Daniel Bryan at the wedding, you know, he was going to have her committed. And so we toyed with the idea of, well, is this just kind of, you know, something that gets us out of the marriage? And, you know, she's not really committed. And, you know, Vince was going to make her the GM and all that. Or, you know, I thought, well, do we actually go through with committing her? And you take her off in the white jackets and, you know, and the men in the white suits, you know, they take her away. And, you know, do you not see her on TV for a while? And then she comes back with Dean Ambrose as her new love interest, whom she met in the institution, and they kind of, you know, take over WWE. So I think that would have been a really fun storyline, and I think it would have been a great way to introduce Dean. But again, to reiterate my earlier, I can't argue with, you know, the fact that we have The Shield. The faction of indie talent, which was, it was going to be, I mean, I don't want to get into, I know we have time constraints, but basically it was going to be I had slated Tommy Dreamer as a guy who kayfabe gets a position as like the WWE scouting director or something like that. It would be just for storyline purposes. And he brings in guys that to the main roster that are guys kind of like him that had his, you know, independent spirit. And maybe they don't have quite the, you know, the right WWE look or the tradition, you know, the size. And the guys he would bring in as this new group, his signees would be Dean and Seth Rollins and Cassius Ohno. And am I leaving someone out? I don't know if it was those three or if that.
I think those are the only three.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, those are the only three. And so we bring them on, and they were going to basically come to make their debut and then turn on Dreamer and basically say that, you know, they don't do things Tommy Dreamer's way. They're going to do things their own way. And they have another leader that they're going to follow and that, you know, will do things by any means necessary. It was going to be Daniel Bryan, who was a heel at the time anyway. So Daniel would lead this faction. And I do think that could have been something really, really good for those guys. But again, you know, two of those guys in that storyline, Seth and Dean, ended up being in the Shield. So I don't think you can say it was, you know, it didn't turn out good for them. Cassius Ohno, Chris Hero, I think it would have been certainly a good spot for him to be in. But, you know, things didn't work out for him at that time. He's back in the fold, so we'll have to see where it goes. But, you know, I think any of those storylines, I think, you know, could have worked. And look, those were just five ideas that I had. There are many, many, many good ideas that come out of the booking room, the writer's room, from all the writers that, you know, never see the light of day. You know, every writer could probably make a list, you know, just as I did,
yeah,
of good ideas that for whatever reason just didn't get greenlighted. You know, the Cody Rhodes Goldust stuff, we were trying to do something there with, you know, that was not going to be necessarily a main event storyline, but it was trying to do something with the Rhodes brothers. And, you know, I had a couple different ideas there. Cody and Caitlin, I was just literally, Cody Rhodes was just doing nothing, basically. And he came back from an injury with that, you know, a horribly cheesy pencil-thin mustache. And Caitlin is a mustache enthusiast. She used to go on social media, and she would talk about it in WWE Magazine about, you know, having this fetish for guys with mustaches. And she wasn't really doing anything either. So I was like, my God, this is just a natural, you know. And what I really liked about, you know, the mustache was just a way in to the storyline, but it was, you know, she was a babyface at the time. Cody was a heel. He was doing the Rhodes Scholars thing with his best friend, Damian Sandow. And it was going to be a classic story of something people could identify with, a guy torn between his best friend and his girlfriend. He's from the wrong side of the tracks. He's a bad boy. She's a good girl. And, you know, I just thought it gave all those talents something to do that was a little more meaningful than what they were doing at the time. And that was my goal a lot of times, was I would look at our roster and look at guys and girls that I thought were being underutilized and didn't have a storyline, and how could we get them involved? That was probably my favorite thing to do there, was trying to, you know, we all pitched ideas for the main event stuff and the upper card guys, but I looked at it as a challenge of how do we get these undercard performers over? How do we give them something meaningful, you know, rather than just, you know, matches that fans sit on their hands for, or, you know, in a more extreme case, these are talents who come to TV and just don't get used, you know? So that's kind of where that thing came from.
My final question for you before we end the show here is do writers compare notes? If you've got a storyline idea to pitch to Vince, do you run it by one or two colleagues first, or as practice, and do others run them by you, or do you guys just kind of have your own idea and pitch them to Vince without consulting each other to kind of get some feedback?
Well, I mean, for the most part, things are vetted inside the writer's room, and there's a structure. We have, you know, head writer. When I first started, the head writer in the office was Brian Gewirtz. So everything was pitched to Brian first. And then in the booking meetings with Vince, which I would be in on, but Brian would present the ideas as, you know, these are coming from the team, not from, hey, Kevin pitched this. You know, it was, he would present what he thought were the best ideas from the team, and he would be the one to present them. Later on, Ed Koski became that guy who would present the ideas that we all brainstormed
okay.
in the writer's room.
Yeah.
But look, there would be times when, let's say I had an idea for a certain storyline in the writer's room, but ultimately, you know, there were seven or eight ideas, and Brian or Ed would say, all right, well, this is the one we're going to present to Vince. If they present it to Vince, and Vince says, well, what else you got? then it opens up for, okay, well, let's go to one of these other ideas. And that's a place where I might speak up and say, well, here's another thing we considered. What about this? And that's kind of the way the process worked. But there was sort of a, like I said, a vetting that took place inside the writer's room where everybody would just kind of throw out their ideas. And, you know, and then from there it would get presented to Vince, usually by one person.
Okay. Did he know whose idea it was? Was it always said? Like, did that sometimes affect maybe his opinion if Ed is presenting a storyline and he goes, well, this was Kevin's idea, let me present it to you? Or was it more collectively, here's ideas for you that we came up with?
Yeah, like I said, it was never anyone taking individual credit
gotcha.
For it initially. It would
yep.
be like, here's what we came up with.
Yep.
But then, like I said, if an idea was, like, if he said, well, what else, or, you know, any other ideas, then, you know, it was up to other people. He would then see who's presenting it. If, you know, there were other people in the room at the time, you know, if I presented it, he'd know it's coming from me or somebody else in there. But yeah, initially, and look, Vince always said, and it's true, he didn't care where an idea came from. Even if it came from a writer's assistant whose sole job was pretty much to take notes, that if they had an idea, you know, I saw plenty of writer's assistants pitch ideas that made it on the TV.
Yeah.
That was Vince's philosophy. Good ideas can come from anywhere. So, you know, it didn't necessarily matter, and it didn't hold any weight, you know, necessarily who it came from. And look, a lot of people would pitch ideas, and they would feel great, like if Vince greenlighted it, and he would, you know, oh, that's good thinking or whatever. But I can guarantee you, 5 minutes later, he couldn't remember who pitched it. You know, so in the long run, it's like, oh, Vince gave me a gold star today. It's like, yeah, he's already forgotten about it.
That's funny. You know? Kevin, thank you for your time as always. We push the limits as always, but I could do this for hours, and it's fascinating. So thanks for your insight and opinions, and taking calls and emails, and writing your blog to give us more insight every week here. Go check it out, Kevin Eck Blog. Go check it out if you're a livecast listener. Just Google Kevin Eck Blog, and it's a top search return, and follow him on Twitter. Also, Kevin, thanks again.
Anytime, Wade.
Excellent. That's Kevin Eck, former creative team member with WWE. You can find his work over at pressboxonline.com or enter Kevin Eck Blog on Google to find his column. Go read it. There's good stuff. There's a lot more to the confessions of a former writer. 5 pitches that were rejected. Romance of Cody Rhodes and Caitlyn, and the whole mustache into a beard foiling the mustache is pretty cool. And Cody and Brandy as the new Goldust and Marlena, pitched in 2014. So it's interesting to read the details, and Kevin kind of spelling out his vision for where these would go, and then to kind of see where they went. And it's just sort of a time capsule too. Like, Daniel Bryan as a heel, just like, every time I hear that, it blows my mind. Like, that never was true, was it? Even though I know it was true. Knowing Brian now, it's like, who could ever boo that guy, and how could he ever be a heel? So anyway, go check that out. Thanks, everybody, for joining me today. If you missed yesterday's show, Jason Powell from ProWrestling.net was my guest co-host, as he is every 3 weeks, and we covered all kinds of topics on the live cast, and then we did a VIP after show after that for, I think, about 45 minutes, covering a wide array of other topics, which is exclusive to VIP members and .NET members. But go check that show out if you haven't yet. It's right under this one on the podcast feed. Or you can find it at pwtorchlivecast.com. This ends my 4 shows this week. I covered Raw with Pat McNeil on Monday night, right after Raw. Then I covered SmackDown Tuesday with Greg Parks. And as I said, Jason Powell yesterday. And then Kevin Eck today. So tonight, Impact Wrestling airs, and Mike McMahon and Andrew Sochek have you covered with a live show right after Impact, so you can listen live or, as always, on demand after the fact, after it airs live. So if you're an Impact Wrestling fan or just want to kind of catch up on what's going on with Impact Wrestling, that's a great way to do it. And then Friday is Primetime Friday with Bruce Mitchell and Rich Fan at 7 Eastern. And then Sunday, after Backlash, it's Pat McNeil and Greg Parks taking your calls and reacting to the pay-per-view. So be sure to tune in live or check it out late Sunday night or Monday morning. We'll have a new show up on the pay-per-view covering Backlash. So lots of stuff coming up in the next few days. We'll be covering on the VIP side everything else every day, including the NXT TakeOver special on Saturday. That should be interesting. It's kind of a, it feels like a B show for NXT TakeOver, but still, I'm curious how Hideo Itami and Robert Roode do together and the chemistry that they have in the ring. You can catch up on NXT storylines if you missed them by checking out our NXT TV reports on pwtorch.com. I encourage you to check out pwtorch.com every day. We'll keep you up to date on the headlines in wrestling and also detailed rundowns of just about every wrestling TV show out there, along with exclusive editorial columns, flashbacks, and much more. That's pwtorch.com. That's for our written reports every day on wrestling, updated every day. MMAtorch.com has you covered in the world of MMA, UFC, Bellator, and more. We'll be covering Bellator Live tomorrow night. It's live on Spike TV, and you can follow along or catch up on MMAtorch.com. And if you are a fan of wrestling podcasts, which you certainly should be if you're listening this deep into this show, or you've made a big mistake, you can keep up on what wrestlers are saying on podcasts or wrestling personalities. Bruce Pritchard, Jim Ross, Sean Waltman, Steve Austin, on and on. Chris Jericho at pwpodcasts.com. There are written reports on tons of wrestler-hosted podcasts. And if you're interested in contributing to that show or to that website by doing written reports on your favorite wrestler-hosted, wrestling personality-hosted podcasts, drop us a line. Actually, drop me a line at kellerwade@gmail.com. That's kellerwade@gmail.com if you're interested in helping out with reports on pwpodcasts.com. But either way, check out the website. There's new content every day. It is fascinating. It is the way to keep up on what wrestlers and wrestling personalities are saying. We also have summaries and news quotes from wrestler interviews done on other podcasts. So check that out. I think it'll become one of your new favorite pro wrestling websites, pwpodcasts.com. That does it for me for today. Thanks, everybody. You can hear me every single day as a VIP member with the Wade Keller Hotline and hear me hosting the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show and The Fix with Todd Martin every week on the VIP side of things, along with other VIP content. Here are details on our retro radio shows that you may find fascinating that comes with a PW Torch VIP membership. As a PW Torch livecast listener, you've probably heard me talk about PW Torch VIP membership. One of the great perks about becoming a PW Torch VIP member at pwtorch.com/govip is access to vintage radio shows that are only available with a PW Torch VIP membership. The entire run of the Pro Wrestling Focus radio show that I hosted on KFAN in the early 1990s, over 100 episodes, available when you sign up instantly. Also, on an ongoing basis, we're adding more Pro Wrestling Spotlight radio shows hosted by John Arezzi in New York, which ran from the late 80s through the mid-1990s. These shows have not been heard since they aired originally on New York radio, and VIP members have access to listen to them exclusively as part of their VIP membership. Also, Total Chaos Radio, hosted by PW Torch livecast Saturday morning wrestling host Jim Valley during the Attitude Era, are also part of a VIP membership, new ones added on a regular basis. These vintage classic radio shows with big name interviews, guest analysts, including me, on a regular basis talking about the news of the day with the hosts, are accessible when you become a VIP member through our ad-free VIP website. You can stream them right on your phone or right on your computer, but also an RSS feed that is accessible only for VIP members via popular apps on iPhone, Android, and even iTunes. Check it out. It's a big perk that comes with a VIP membership. Get details at pwtorch.com/govip. That's pwtorch.com/govip. Have a blast listening to familiar voices from this live cast talk about wrestling from the 1990s through the Attitude Era exclusively as a PW Torch VIP member. Follow me on Twitter at The Wade Keller. Follow our brand at PW Torch. And follow our sister site at MMA Torch. And follow our newer site at PW Podcast. That'll do it for me for today. Thanks again to Kevin Eck. Thanks to Jason Powell yesterday. And Torch columnists Pat McNeil and Greg Parks. It's always a pleasure doing the show and talking pro wrestling. Thank you for your support of the PW Torch livecast. I'm Wade Keller, signing off for this week. Thanks, everybody, once again, for joining us.